It is Wednesday, March the 19th. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Thanks for being here. Part two with Dr. Hanscom and I. Let's get into the show. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. I am so happy that you are here. I want to make sure that I thank the patrons of the show. Go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. If you want to throw a few extra bucks in the tip jar, I'm so grateful for all of you. This is part two of Dr. Hanscom and I. We went through part one last week. We talked about FOMO. We talked about jealousy. We talked about complex consciousness. We're going to pick up on that and do part two of that interview right now. So I hope that you enjoy this part two with Dr. Hanscom and I coming up right now.
We watch people suffering. We cheer for the underdog. We watch horror movies. We want the good guy to win, the bad guy to lose. That's all Schadenfreude. That's all tall poppy syndrome. And, you know, we want to have justice. And so as opposed to creating joy, which is actually the final solution, is that we're trying to put out our pain. And so then we try positive thinking, which doesn't work. We try mindfulness and meditation, which can have some effect. And there's a lot of things to do to actually calm down the stress physiology and reroute it. So I'm not going to go into the solution today, but what I really want to emphasize is that what drives these repetitive, unpleasant thoughts is stress physiology. Unless we have, and it's powerful, a million times stronger than your conscious brain. So unless we have a way of calming that down, we're at the mercy of our physiology, we're at the mercy of our thoughts. And the only thing we know what to do instinctively is actually hurt somebody else or watch somebody else be hurt.
Can you, there's like a cousin of something that you've said that I've thought of, the FOMO and the jealousy and lights up the pain circuits and things like that. Something I think a lot about, I was just talking about this morning with I call him my TMS friend, just because we're two guys about the same age that kind of, you know, we have a appreciation for this line of work. And I forgot exactly what he'd said. He took some kind of a digital course and he's going to some retreat that for me made me think of the word indecisiveness. That's something I've struggled with for eons, being indecisive about generally everything. Really questioning, you know, decisions, or it can be something as stupid as looking at two competing smartphones that I want. I want them for different reasons. And if you could combine them, that would be perfect. But I can't get this one because I don't want to make the wrong choice or this one. You know what I mean? Like, but it's about a lot of things on indecisive. And it's usually about just trivial, stupid stuff like that. It's not often like I want to go on two different vacations and I got to pick one. And if I pick this one, I'll screw the whole thing up. It's never about stuff that is bigger in the grand scheme of things. It's always about dumb little things. Do you have any commentary on that, on indecisiveness in general and how it, because, you know, you can get into this stupid thought pattern where you're thinking about it way more, like, you know, the racing obsessive thoughts.
Well, there's a bunch of layers to this, and I'm trying to keep, I mean, I don't have an exact answer here because there's not an exact answer, but remember what's driving you crazy is actually the thoughts, right? Mm-hmm. So you have anxiety about making a decision, and anxiety is basically, we talked about this before, anxiety is simply the sensation generated by fight or flight chemistry, threat physiology. So you're anxious, and your mind starts spinning, then you have all these spinning about what I should or shouldn't do. Then when you're frustrated, your thinking brain goes offline, making the decision even harder. So in medicine, we call it learned helplessness. I call it being a victim, poor me, I can't make a decision, or for me, my to-do list is too long. And so adversity is adversity, but it's when you start feeling sorry for yourself is when you really double down. Mm-hmm. And that's what you do in depression with it. We know anxiety, depression, OCD, bipolar, and schizophrenia are all inflammatory metabolic disorders. And so if your baseline state is sort of anxious, looking around, again, there's two things. There's the actual decision, and then there's the thoughts around it. So the spinning thoughts is what takes you out of the game because it sucks in a lot of energy. So I'm going to go back to the whole basic thing here. Okay, you're a good guy. I don't know you very well, but you're obviously a good guy, well-intentioned. So I'm guessing you have more unpleasant thoughts than you would like to admit to. Mm-hmm. Can I ask you that question?
Yep.
Okay, so what do you do with them? So if you try to actually make decisions to solve the thoughts, that doesn't work. In other words, actually solving the problem as getting the thoughts spinning doesn't solve it, because your thoughts are going to something else. So the problem is the spinning thoughts. So again, this is a whole, let me just jump. The course I put together called the DOC Journey solves the problem. And it's not a magic course. It just teaches you two things. There's two parts of healing. One is learn how to live with your stress physiology and calm it down and quit reacting to it. Anxiety is anxiety, anger is anger, schadenfreude is schadenfreude. So you train your brain to be with your pain, not to react to it. So you have this problem with indecision-making. These thought patterns keep spinning away. You want to be less anxious, so you fight the anxiety. So somehow if you feel like if you became more decisive, the anxiety would drop, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Doesn't.
Based on what we're saying today.
Doesn't.
What's that? Good luck. No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I was amazed. I mean, so when you talk to people, everybody has ruts. Everybody has schadenfreude. Nobody wants to talk about it because it's disgusting. Why would I get pleasure out of somebody else's suffering?
Because
mm-hmm. that's what humans do. Every one of us. Now, my thing has got me in deep trouble. I was totally connected to my facade or identity being calm, cool, collected. I was a major spine surgeon. I could do anything. My attitude was bring it on. You can't break me. And let's take perfectionism. Are you hard on yourself?
Less now than years ago. Coincidentally, when I was in far more pain, I was very hard on myself.
Because a self-critical voice is actually a form of tall poppy.
Yeah.
Because you're in pain, mental pain, let's say mental pain or the thoughts. And if you get self-critical and literally or feel guilty, which is anger turned inward. So by being critical of yourself as well as being critical of other people, first of all, you're projecting yourself onto other people and vice versa. But the bottom line is that the more and more self-critical you are, the less pain you have. So self-critical voice isn't just this programming against your stress physiology that you want to get relief from, and you can't turn it off. And one of my physician friends made a comment that if I just hate myself enough, nobody else can hate me more.
Mm-hmm.
She had an autoimmune disorder, lots of chronic pain, all sorts of things. She's actually out of it completely. And my thing is, I remember when I was 14 years old, I was so self-critical, so perfectionistic. I remember my younger brother, Alan, saying, David, quit kicking yourself. I go, huh? So I thought perfectionism was a positive trait. It's actually deadly as can be. Probably the most insidious form of this whole process is perfectionism, because there's no perfect. So a situation that's, so the genealogy of anger is situation, blame, victim, anger. So if you're perfectionistic standards, why your situation is less than perfect, you've been in a situation or yourself are being less than perfect, you blame, be less than perfect, you're always a victim and you're always frustrated. So David Burns, who wrote the book Feeling Good, pointed out the delta between your reality and your perception of perfectionism is the degree of your unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
That line changed my life. I thought being perfectionistic was a positive trait. You look at advertisements, you look at the world, they keep holding up perfectionism as a standard. It's the most insidious form of anger that exists. But again, it's programming into our psyche.
You know, one thing this is making me think of, and I wish I would have written it down when you said it, because it was, it really reminded me of something my daughter had said to me really recently. I'll give you a breakdown. I know we don't have a ton of time, and this is one of those, didn't build Rome in a day, can't solve this issue in a day. I've talked about my older daughter, and as time has gone on, one of the things that she, and I've tried to kind of put my finger on it for a while, and I still don't necessarily know what it is. But she is struggling a lot with confidence, just in general, like about a lot of things. And where this has come up a lot in the last few weeks is she had never played basketball before, wanted to start playing basketball this season. She started, and you know, she's not a super athlete, like she's not a great athlete, but she will try things. And so I do really admire that, because a lot of kids just won't. She joined this basketball team, didn't know anybody on the team. The coach has a very different style from all the other coaches that she's had. She's not very nurturing. She tends to yell a lot. Like, she's a little harder on the kids than I ever, and I've been a kids coach for a long time. She's a lot harder on the kids than I would ever be. Zoe really interprets that as a very negative thing. And that's been difficult to, you know, to talk about with her. But my thought is, like, she's played 7 or 8 games, and the difference in progress from game 1 to game 7, which is what she just played, has been incredible to watch. Amazing. She doesn't seem to see that. As much as I pump her up after the games, it's just kind of, I didn't do very good, you know, anything like that. I was watching the last 15 minutes of her practice on Monday, and they were having a shooting contest. I think there's 10 girls on the team. And they do this at the end of every practice. Zoe consistently will be in the final three. So meaning she's performing very well, not missing shots. Whether she wins or she finishes third, or even if she finished last, I feel like her response is always the same. So there was a girl there that I didn't know that was encouraging her before every shot. Go, Zoe. Like, you can do it. And I loved seeing it. In fact, I sent her mom a note. I didn't know her mom. Sent her mom a note just to let her know how much I appreciated that. When we were walking back to the car, my younger daughter says to Zoe, why do you think that girl was giving you so much encouragement, but she wasn't saying it to the other girls? And there's a million responses you could have on that. I don't know what it was. Maybe she has a connection with Zoe in some way, but, you know, they're not friends. They don't go to the same school. None of that. Zoe's snap response, didn't even have to think about it. She said, because she feels pity for me because I'm not very good at this. And that has so stuck with me. I went and bought a couple of books that are written by kids about confidence in girls that are in that tween phase. Again, I'm sure you don't have a solution for this in the next couple of minutes.
Actually, Andy, I do. This my whole project. Because now here's the thing. Your highest level of expertise becomes your monster. In other words, this is, she's an incredible basketball player. And this happens in the mental health world and in the high-level professional Olympic-level athletes, is that, or whether you're a musician or ballet or dance or sports or, you know, rocket scientist, your identity becomes your monster because you're defining yourself by it. So again, we become comfortable with anxiety. You don't need an ego to defend yourself. And the way we defend, my identity, of course, is being a major spine surgeon. There was never enough to do it. So you keep pushing, but you cannot outrun your stress physiology. You can't do it. So no matter what she does, you can. So actually pumping her up, unfortunately, works the opposite direction. It works completely the opposite. So reassurance, you have these circuits spinning away. When you're reassuring yourself that you're okay, it's like spinning a basketball on your finger. You're paying attention to it. It spins faster. You try to ignore those circuits. It actually spins even faster. So that's the skill set of separating from the stress physiology and let it do what it does. And then these thoughts start spinning around as much. You don't have to combat the anxiety and schadenfreude with thoughts. And the thoughts drop down. And then I don't want to go too far off track here, but the way healing occurs, I call it the sequence of healing, and the metaphor is that of a tree. And the soil is your past, your whole entire life experience up to this very second. So it starts with connection. As the roots go into the soil of your past, you get to be with it, negative and positive. So the skill set is quit reacting to adversity. I mean, adversity is never going to be positive. I am not into positive thinking. But with awareness, you learn to be with your past, watch what's happening. You learn to withhold judgment. Instead of trying to whitewash it, analyze it, fix it, compensate for it, you just learn to be with your past. Okay, so let's say she's a terrible basketball player. Well, okay, you just learn to be with that. You don't have to fix it, solve it. So then the trunk of the tree is the confidence are the tools that actually learn how to process all this, lower your anger, lower your anxiety, be with the schadenfreude, be with your pain. It all takes skills. So the emphasis is on attaining the skills to actually be with your past and get the skills to move forward. So that calls the three C's, the sequence, the letter C, sequence of healing is connection first to everything, positive and negative. The C is the trunk of the tree, which is the confidence to be with every aspect of your past. Then the real healing occurs with creativity at the top of the tree when you stimulate neuroplasticity to do what you want to do on your terms instead of compensating for your negativity. That's where the healing occurs. So instead of fighting these circuits, you actually create a whole new nervous system. It's like putting a virtual desktop on your computer. Mm-hmm. This new desktop doesn't have all these crazy pain circuits. So it's obviously more complicated than that, but that's the basic thing I've learned is that we all have adversity. Adversity is never going to stop. We all have anxiety. We need it to stay alive. We all have anger. You need it to stay alive. We all have schadenfreude because it's a survival sensation that allows more access to resources, but it also decreases your pain, including the self-critical voice. So as much as you want to try to reassure her, she has her own mental pain like all of us do. And so she's going to keep going to the self-critical voice to actually decrease her mental pain. And I'm going to say one quick outline. I wanted to do this on another day. So these repetitive thought patterns are solvable, period. And they're solvable by addressing the driving force of the stress physiology. And again, you learn to be with it, quit reacting to it. So the first part, preliminary step, is actually separating your identity as a person from these survival reactions. And Schadenfreude is actually one opportunity to help define stress physiology. So the first real step is to call it thought separation. That's what the expressive writing does. You write your thoughts down, tear them up. Mindfulness does that. Cognitive restructuring or cognitive behavioral therapy does that. So I call it thought separation. The second part is turn down the heat, calm your physiology, deal with anger, learn to calm your anger down, not to get rid of it, not to conquer it, learn to be with your anger. So you can be angry. The question is, do you act on it?
Mm-hmm.
You can have Schadenfreude. The question is, do you act on it? In other words, do you do tall poppy? Do you tall poppy somebody because you can't tolerate it? So tolerating your uncomfortable feelings is the key to this whole process. So again, it's thought separation. Number two, turn on the heat. The third part is killing your ego. Now, you can't just kill your ego. Remember, your ego form is a defense against these negative feelings. So as you learn to process negative feelings and be with them, your ego starts to soften. Then the definitive part is what we just talked about, is neuroplasticity. So you learn to live with your survival physiology. Then you learn to nurture peace, love, joy, good food, good wine, good friends. That's where the healing occurs. The other three steps are to get yourself ready to do this. They all occur simultaneously, every day, all day long. It's not a self-help process. We call it deep healing, whereas you learn to give your body what we call cues of safety. Your body chemistry changes. So you go to safety physiology, where fuel goes into the cells, the inflammation drops, metabolism drops, and your body regeneration heals. The healing that I witnessed hundreds of times, including myself, is profound. It's a miracle. But it's not me. It's not some course. It's not some process. So self-help means I'm going to get some tools together so I have less pain, mental or physical, but the pain's running the show. Deep healing means you learn to be with the pain, quit reacting to it, give your body what we call cues of safety. Your body heals itself. It's a completely opposite process. You have to actually let go to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I covered a lot of ground in that sentence, but anyway, let me just, in the big picture, that's why I'm still working on trying to refine it so it's easier for people to access. But, you know, I have the book Back in Control, which gives you sort of a background to it. I did not know the physiology of all this stuff until, you know, 2020. It's called The DLC Journey, Direct Your Own Care Journey, which gives the template and the sequence of how to learn these steps. The emphasis is on the skills, not the pain. I also put together some flip books called The Missing Piece, P-E-A-C-E, that gives overviews of the process. So again, it's a learned skill set. Become an expert at life skills. You become an expert at processing adversity. You become an expert at nurturing joy. They're two separate skill sets. They're obviously linked because you can't nurture joy if you're in stress physiology. So that's where you have to learn to do both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in stress and triggered, you can't nurture joy. Not going to happen. So that's why it's not like I'm going to have this amount of joy and I'm going to be fixed. Some days are good. Some days are bad. So you just learn to dynamically process your life. You learn to ride the waves more quickly. You spend less time in stress physiology, more time in safety. And at some tipping point, your body regenerates and heals. So everything we talked about becomes sort of irrelevant. I had 17 different physical and mental symptoms for 15 solid years. They're gone. My ears don't ring. I don't have migraine headaches. My feet don't burn. I don't have crippling anxiety. I don't have obsessive thought patterns. They're just gone. Because my body physiology is calmed down.
Somebody asked about tinnitus in the Facebook group a few weeks ago, and I recommended you because I think you talked about that, right?
Yeah. Almost. There's a fair number of people. I need to do a survey and get a more accurate number. And I don't know what the percent chances of are, but people regularly tell me that tinnitus is markedly better as they go through the course.
That's great. Because that's one of the things some of the more abstract's not the right word, but I don't hear about them with a lot of regularity. But when they do, people seem to have a real problem. It's not, I sort of have tinnitus. It's, this is driving me nuts. It's not,
yeah, it's bad.
I sort of have a toothache. It's my mouth hurts. My mouth really, really hurts. So there's a lot of things that are kind of in that peripheral that I hear about, but not with regularity. But sometimes I do, and it jumps out at me.
So Eddie, do me a favor. So I know I gave you access to the course, right? Yeah.
I don't think so. No.
No, I did.
Oh, you did?
I just looked at it. Yeah, so you have a coupon.
Oh, great.
So,
look, okay.
The course is about 10 or 15 minutes a day. That's it. If you rush through it to get fixed, you're going to be overwhelmed, frustrated, inflamed, and it's worse.
Yeah.
So look at this as a 3 to 6 month project, just 10 or 15 minutes a day. Go through one course, maybe a video or two, and just watch what happens. Mm-hmm. So as you learn to regulate your own physiology and change your nervous system, it has a dramatic effect on your. How old's your daughter?
I call her 11. She's 10, but 10 or 11.
So it has a dramatic effect to the mirror neurons effect on your family. Huge. So the best thing you can do for your daughter is not try to teach her, fix her, let her be with what she does. Mm-hmm. And as you learn the tools yourself, and that's my personal commitment, is I want to manifest what I'm teaching. I used to be in this talking head and teach it all the time. I just want to be it. I want to be what I'm teaching. And you'll find out as you learn the skills and start to incorporate them in your daily life, it's not work. It's not a big project. It's intended to be sort of a playful experience, curious gratitude, just simple steps. And, you know, of course, you monitor your progress. It's a problem. You try not to monitor your progress. It's more of a problem. So you just go through the course and just watch what happens. You become an observer of your own healing.
Yeah.
And, you know, over 3 to 6 months, I'm happy to talk to you about it intermittently as we go along, but it's my, I mean, I quit my practice because of this, not because I wanted to manage chronic pain. Mm-hmm. I just was watching people transform at a level that I did not understand. Now I understand the physiology of the body. It makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah. Excellent. We ran quite a bit over. Is there anything else that's on the tip of your tongue that we didn't touch on? We touched on a lot.
I gave you a thousandth of what I would like to say. I'm serious. This is the barely tip of the iceberg. So the thing is, once you start to feel better, you've actually just started the journey. Mm-hmm. There's no beginning or end point to it. And so I do want to summarize one thing that I learned from my scientific group this week. Dr. Bernie Siegel wrote a book called Love, Medicine, Miracles back in the 80s. It's a very famous book. He's a pediatric thoracic surgeon. He's a remarkable person. And he figured this stuff out in the 1970s and 80s, way before this was really talked about. So he had a group called Exceptional Cancer Survivors. These are people with terminal cancer who forgot to die. And I've tried for 10 years to figure out from Bernie, well, what's going on? Who are these people? Why do they survive? Not that it was some sort of magical formula or some innate characteristic that allowed them to survive. It's not true. He said, he called it self-induced healing. I go, what do you mean? So what happens is that they quit trying to fix themselves and decided to live the life they want to live today. They don't look at tomorrow. They just feel, I'm living life today right now. And you quit being a people pleaser. You obviously aren't selfish, but you just live your life in your terms and you make changes. You make the changes you wanted to make your entire life. You just do it now. And as people make the changes, whether it's careers, marriage, just the way they look at things, they make the definitive, they take control. As they take control, the body chemistry changes from threat to safety. Mm-hmm. And so these are stage 4 terminal cancers. And 10 years later, they're still around doing their thing, cancer free.
Yeah, wow.
But it's the same thing about living for today. That's it. We're trying to hope for some magical solution. Do you take full responsibility for every aspect of your life, which i.e. is the opposite of anger? And is the exact same characteristics that allow people to heal from chronic pain. Mm-hmm. Exact same thing. Blew me away.
Excellent. Well, thank you for sharing that. Dr. Hanscom, thank you for being here. I'll be in touch at some point in the next couple of months. I'm gonna go through my email for the coupon code and the access, and I'm gonna keep
it posted. I'll resend it to you right now just to make sure you have it.
Cool.
And let's do it.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thanks for being here and have a good rest of the week.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.